look to us because the international community and the United States profess the values of protecting.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Inside Politics. I'm John King in Washington. You're watching a fiery speech on the floor of the House of Representatives. That is Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. The House is about to vote to kick her off the House Foreign Affairs Committee. She is speaking right now saying, yes, she's a Muslim. Yes, she's a refugee. Yes, she has said some controversial things, but she says she's a proud American and her views should be considered by Republicans and Democrats alike. Let's listen.
And stronger, and my leadership will be celebrated around the world as it has been. So take your vote or not. I am here to stay, and I am here to be a voice against harms around the world and advocate for a better world. I yield back.
Again, Ilhan Omar speaking, a fiery address, a defiant speech on the floor of the House of Representatives. The Republican-led House is about to vote to kick her off the House Foreign Affairs Committee. She says it is retribution. She says it is unfair. She says it is un-American. But she says it is no surprise to her, tracing Donald Trump's support of the birther movement, the Republicans who said Barack Obama, as president, was secretly a Muslim. Let's get to our chief congressional correspondent, Manu Raju. Manu, this vote, you just heard the defiance from Congressman Omar, the vote that will take place in moments, is a key test of the new speaker, Kevin McCarthy. He has a very narrow majority, and many of his members are a little squishy about this.
Yeah, no question about it. He can only lose four Republican votes in order to allow this to succeed, to kick her off of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And he has been moving behind the scenes over the last several days to shore up concerns about this tit-for-tat that has occurred after Democrats moved two Republicans off of their committee assignments last Congress, McCarthy vowing some retribution of sorts for Ilhan Omar ever since that happened here. And a lot of Republicans agreeing with them, but some concerned about it. But behind the scenes, McCarthy has locked up the votes. He has indicated that he has made sure that his members are in line. Just moments ago, Congresswoman Nancy Mace, who is one who had said that she would oppose this because of her concern about the precedent this would set by kicking off another member of the committee, expanding the precedent from the last Congress, she said she's actually going to vote for this because she got an agreement from the Speaker to figure out a new process going forward to allow members to appeal any effort to try to kick them off of the committee. There's going to be some language change to the resolution here, and that's one reason why. And there's Congressman George Santos here. Mr. Santos, can you explain, did you set up a fake GoFundMe account to try to defraud and cheat a veteran out of $3,000? So can you explain if that happened? Mr. Santos, why does he have text messages saying that you set up this fake GoFundMe account? Mr. Santos, you're facing a federal investigation here. This is very serious. Can you explain to your voters and your constituents what happened with this veteran, the conversations that you had with him? Mr. Santos, you have a chance now to clear up the fabrications from your career. You made up where you worked from Citigroup, Goldman Sachs. Why did you make that up, sir? Can you explain that to voters here? Are you going to resign? Wouldn't it be better for your voters if you resigned your seat in Congress, sir? Mr. Santos? So as you can see, John, we're covering various issues here at the same time. One, Ilhan Omar, as we're talking about here, one serious issue. Another one, George Santos, the congressman from New York, the Republican who is embattled, of course, facing numerous investigations, a federal investigation, one of which that we learned about yesterday to look into allegedly setting up a GoFundMe account, a fake GoFundMe account, and scamming a homeless veteran out of money, $3,000 or so. There's an investigation that appears to be happening out of New York. Tried to ask him about that, if he actually did that. Not answering that question or about all the other fabrications from his life. So, John, that's one issue. The other issue about to happen here on the House floor, the House about to vote to kick off Ilhan Omar from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. There is a belief among the Republican leadership they will have the votes to do just that here, as many things are happening here, developing at the same time here, John.
I'm going to come back to that in just a moment, to the news part of it. Connect the dots for me here. One of the reasons Kevin McCarthy, the speaker, has stood by George Santos so far is because in that vote that's about to happen, guess what? Kevin McCarthy needs George Santos's vote, correct?
Yeah, he does. In fact, that's one big reason why he has not called on him to resign. Now, McCarthy did tell us yesterday when he came back from the White House that he has, quote, new questions about Santos. And that is one reason why he supports the decision of Santos to get off of those two House committees, that he had made that voluntary decision to step aside there. But McCarthy would not say what those new questions were, whether they're about his campaign finances, which, of course, appears to be part of this investigation into him going forward. But McCarthy has so far not called on him to resign, even though we've heard Republican after Republican back home, New York Republicans, including some in the delegation here in the House, asking for his ouster. McCarthy's still not going that far, not just because he needs the votes for Ilhan Omar or even to get elected speaker, but also, John, as you know, if he stepped aside, that would be problematic, could flip, that district could flip to be Democratic, and the tightening McCarthy's already very narrow majority.
Mano Raju, live for us on Capitol Hill. My friend, whatever they pay you, it is not enough. And Congressman Santos is new to the building. He's going to learn where the stairs are.
Yeah.
You could figure that out right there. Let's bring the conversation in the room with me to share their reporting and their insights. CNN's Dana Bash, CNN's Nia Malika Henderson, and Sungmin Kim of the Associated Press. And we can show you the House floor. They are now voting. This is the full House voting on whether to remove Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota, from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. It is a big act. The Republicans say Democrats did it. We're coming back to it. Dana Bash, you covered Congress for a long time. Number one, you know what Mano's, you know the job Mano's doing, which is spectacular. Asking the right questions of the right people. Yeah. There will be people out there saying, you know, why are you asking these questions of George Santos? Well, he's been elected and he won't answer questions that need to be asked. This vote, there were qualms from a number of Republicans saying, okay, Democrats did this to Marjorie Taylor Greene, Democrats did this to Paul Gosar, but we're evicting her from the committee because she said some controversial, reprehensible things, anti-Semitic things, which she has apologized for. There is a difference, even some Republicans say, and yet it looks like this vote will succeed.
Yeah, I mean, listen, she sat right in this chair where I'm sitting for our show on Sunday for State of the Union, and she admitted to ignorance on a lot of the tropes that she was parroting and said that she learned from it. You talked about Republicans who, some of whom, three of whom actually, had said that they would vote with the Democrats. They wouldn't kick her off the committee, and now they have flipped back. We haven't talked a lot about some of her fellow Democrats who were and still are very unhappy with the statements that she's made. Right before she went onto the floor, Congresswoman Omar joined in at co-sponsoring a resolution with some moderate Democrats, some Jewish Democrats, specifically recognizing Israel as America's legitimate and democratic ally and condemning anti-Semitism, which might sound like a no-brainer, but it was, I'm told, after many, many weeks of negotiation to try to get her there so that some Democrats, all Democrats likely, will feel comfortable in voting the way they are right now for her, basically.
Forgive me for interrupting. As you watch the vote play out, you can see Congressman Omar staying right there on the floor. She knows what's about to happen. She wants to be there as it happens. She wants to stare down the Republicans as they vote to kick her off this committee. And I'd mentioned Marjorie Taylor Greene. The Democrats kicked her off committees because of some reprehensible things she said. And she turned it in her lane of American politics into celebrity. She raised a ton of money of it. Here's my question. Let's listen to Congressman Omar first. She seems very determined. Mm-hmm. Fine. You're going to do this to me? Guess what? I'm not going away. I'm going to have even a louder voice. And here in this speech, she very poignantly talked about leaving war-torn Africa, coming to America as a refugee. She says that should make her welcomed as an American. Instead, she says this Republican Party wants to shun her.
I am Muslim. I am an immigrant. And interestingly, from Africa. Is anyone surprised that I am being targeted?
She will not be on the Foreign Affairs Committee, most likely, by the end of the day, but she seems quite determined to have even a bigger platform.
That's right. And listen, she'll be on other committees. Her voice probably will likely get stronger and more prominent. Very passionate and powerful speech when she talks about her journey from Africa. She was born in Somalia and came here as a refugee. You know, listen, there does seem to be a pattern from Republicans in terms of targeting people. And I think she was alluding to that. She talked about, obviously, interestingly, being from Africa. That was, if you remember what Donald Trump said about Africa, calling it a country, not a continent. But there does seem to be a pattern of sort of targeting brown people, targeting immigrants, targeting the other, essentially. And that seems to be what she is saying. This is reflective of it. It's reflective of some of the things that the Republican Party has done over these last many years. And she's saying she's not going anywhere. She's standing there as this vote is happening. And she's going to be around and she's going to be a powerful voice.
It's interesting because what we just saw Manu trying to interview a congressman who owes the American people, owes his constituents back in New York answers. When people come to town, often they make mistakes. Ilhan Omar has made mistakes. So the question is, can they build, can they get forgiveness from their members? You mentioned the Jewish Democrats who had huge qualms about, not just qualms, that's an understatement, huge objections and opposition and anger at what she said in the past. Dan Goldman is also a new member of Congress, but he's not new to Washington. He's familiar with this. Listen to what he said earlier today about, yes, she has said things that offend me and more, but...
Look, I'm as a proud American Jew, you know, I'm not thrilled about the anti-Semitic comments that she and many others have made. But this is just clear retribution that Kevin McCarthy agreed to in order to become Speaker of the House.
Everyone will have their views on what this is, but it also comes in the very early days of this new Congress and new divided government. The speaker just met with the president yesterday. They both emerged saying we're going to try to have a respectful conversation, even though we disagree completely. But how will something like this affect the tone? The Democrats and the Republicans are already the gap of trust, the gap of respect is pretty wide. Does this make it worse?
I mean, I don't think it makes things better. And I think the difference between someone like Ilhan Omar and her comments and Marjorie Taylor Greene, like we discussed, and what she has said, Ilhan Omar has shown remorse and apology for those remarks. I don't recall Marjorie Taylor Greene ever having remorse or apologies. And instead of being punished in this Congress like the way she was in the previous Congress and how Congresswoman Omar is being punished now, Marjorie Taylor Greene has parlayed into a position of power. She is a major counsel to Speaker McCarthy. So that is another difference in the ways that the two parties have approached this.
That's a great point to make. And again, we're watching this vote and we'll bring you the final tally when it is done. The vote being cast right now, likely to be quite a party divide, to remove Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota, from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Again, we'll bring you the numbers when they are final. Up next for us, though, Hunter Biden's new strategy. He's asking state and federal prosecutors to investigate critics he says are illegally weaponizing his personal data. This news just into CNN. Republicans announcing today their choice to respond to President Biden's State of the Union address next week. It will be the newly elected Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Sanders says she's grateful for the opportunity to detail what she calls the GOP's optimistic vision for the future. Let's bring the conversation in the room. This is an interesting choice. She has been governor for a month, and we just showed the photo of her standing at the White House lectern. Republicans might like her as a chief defender of Donald Trump. She also stood at that podium time after time after time after time and lied for Donald Trump. And now she's going to respond to the president's
statement. Yeah, listen, you know, this is a big wet kiss to Donald Trump in so many ways. I don't think most Americans have very fond memories of her necessarily because of how she conducted herself behind the podium. We know what she seems to want to do in Arkansas, a lot of sort of anti-woke stuff. Drag queens are terrible, and black history shouldn't be taught in a certain way in school. So those are sort of, I think, the probably will be some of the highlights or lowlights of her address to Biden. But this is an interesting choice, and I think it tells you where the Republican Party is.
Is part of it. You mentioned that Trump will like this because he's loyal to Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Is part of this that they look around for a governor? They don't want somebody in Washington, and they don't want to get involved in 2024, so you can't pick Ron DeSantis or you can't do this? Yeah, is that maybe it?
Yeah, that's part of it. But they also have some really, really interesting new members, if they're looking for somebody who was just sworn in, of their own House majority. Who have fantastic backstories. One, Siskamani, is just coming to mind, who was born in Mexico and is a proud Republican now representing the Tucson area in Arizona. And there are others like that. But you're right. This is a very deliberate decision to pick somebody who's not only female, not only a governor, but somebody with a very famous name and a very famous role previous to being governor.
Well, it'll be interesting as we play out. All right, now we're going to move on to this new, much more aggressive strategy from the president's son, Hunter Biden's legal team. Remember, Hunter Biden is under investigation by the U.S. attorney in Delaware. Now his lawyers are trying to change the narrative. They're asking state and federal prosecutors to investigate conservative activists, including Steve Bannon and Rudy Giuliani, over Hunter Biden claims those folks and others illegally weaponized his personal information, purportedly found in a laptop that Hunter Biden left at a Delaware repair shop. Now, the letters do not acknowledge the laptop belongs to Hunter Biden, but it is the first time the president's son publicly acknowledged the personal data does belong to him. CNN's Evan Perez joins our panel. I'm baffled by this one. Abby Lowell is part of Hunter Biden's new strategy. He has represented a lot of political clients, if you will, over the years, and he is aggressive. He is a boxer, if you will. But what are they up to here?
Yeah, I mean, knife fighter, right? And I think what he's trying to do, Hunter Biden, is trying to change, he's trying to turn the tables, really, on these people that have really spent the last 4 years trying to make him the punching bag, trying to use him as a political cudgel, really, against his father. And, you know, I think, you know, certainly for the last few years, whenever we tried to do stories on what were in the contents of these this laptop, you didn't hear very much in response from them. So now they're saying that these people committed crimes. They want the state attorneys general and the attorney general in Delaware and the Justice Department to investigate these people. But it does represent this huge strategy shift because they know now that Republicans have the gavel. They're going to be doing hearings, they're going to be doing investigations, and it allows them to try to take the fight to the Republicans.
Do they perhaps know something about the actual federal investigation? We'll get to the House Republicans and the oversight, or whatever they want to call it, investigations in a minute. But it just seems striking to me, from a legal standpoint, when you're under investigation by a U.S. attorney, that you essentially, you know, turn and say, look at the people accusing me, not me.
Right, exactly. And I think that's one of the things they're trying to do is they're trying to say, hey, before you close out this investigation, before you perhaps maybe bring charges, right, which is something we know is being considered, maybe you ought to take another look at what happened to my personal information. Why aren't you charging these people? Why aren't you investigating these people before you come after me?
A timing question, Sungmin Kim. The president delivers a State of the Union address next week.
Right.
We are in the early days of a divided government. Joe Biden is preparing to announce his 2024 reelection campaign. Hunter Biden in the news? Hunter Biden aggressively in the news? Is that what they want at the White House?
Well, you know, he's going to be in the news one way or the other, obviously, with the focus from House Republicans on him. And I think a lot of it is that he is, you know, you not only fight these in the actual courts, but oftentimes you fight them in the court of public opinion. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if Hunter Biden's team has seen some of the polling and the public sentiment out there that said, you know, the American voters would like for Congress to focus on actual issues rather than, you know, investigating the president's personal family. And maybe perhaps they're trying to capitalize on that, be much more aggressive. But, you know, I'd be very interested in, like, asking the White House, what do they think of this? They're not going to answer, but it'd be interesting to hear what they say.
And so listen to that point, because the House Republicans just yesterday started their investigative hearings. It was about the border yesterday. It was about COVID spending. But they promised, perhaps in several different committees, to get to Hunter Biden. And these Republican chairmen, Republican leaders say they want to find the facts. But if you listen, it also seems like they already have their conclusion.
There's a lot of evidence on the hard drive that would suggest that Joe Biden knew very well what his family was involved in.
Jamie Comer's exposed a lot of this already, and his committee is going to still be finding more of it regarding the Hunter Biden laptop, which really shows things that Joe Biden himself was doing.
This is the focus on the Judiciary Committee, the political nature at the Justice Department, and the linkage now to what was happening with the Hunter Biden story.
Again, you know, legal investigations, Hunter Biden now making specific legal accusations against some of his critics. Those are substantive matters of the law. A lot of politics here.
A lot of politics, a lot of conspiracy theories as well. We'll see what these investigations are going to find out from the DOJ's perspective and the Oversight Committee. Right. DOJ saying they're not necessarily going to cooperate with this. But listen, I think if you're the White House, you're probably glad that Hunter Biden is fighting back at this point. Joe Biden can't really do it. Democrats can't necessarily get it. So if you're the White House, you know, push back against the folks who are making these claims against your son, or you're glad that Hunter Biden is doing it at this point, because he has been such a big target and a growing target. I mean, these conspiracy theories have kind of grown and metastasized over the last couple of years.
All right, we're going to move on to another question of law and order. It's a lot happening in the news today. This just into CNN. The FBI now plans to search the Indiana home of the former vice president, Mike Pence. Evan Perez still with us. Just for context for the viewers at home,
yeah.
They probably are aware of this. Pence, Donald Trump first, President Biden, and Mike Pence all have had classified documents turn up in places they don't belong,
right.
Including at Pence's Carmel, Indiana home, where he said they were found and then immediately turned over by everything we know publicly, did the right thing, not in bringing them there, but once he discovered them, now what?
Right. Well, I mean, this is something I've been hinting at in the last few days, that we expected that this was going to be the next thing. Certainly because, you know, Mike Pence's team want to try to get this wrapped up. They don't have a special counsel, unlike President Biden, who is now the subject of a special counsel investigation. Of course, Donald Trump is also the subject of a special counsel investigation. Nobody wants a special counsel. So if you're Mike Pence, you want to cooperate and make this as painless as possible. One of the best ways to do that is to invite the FBI to come consensually do a search of the home in Carmel, Indiana, which he just moved into recently. So it probably is an easy search to do. He also has an office here in Washington, a think tank office, which they would want to do as well. So it's something we've been watching, we've been waiting for, we thought might happen perhaps as soon as today. And, you know, I think it's going to happen in the next coming days, because for Pence, you want to try to get this story wrapped up as soon as possible.
It's not just because of a special counsel, because he wants to run for president.
That's right.
Right. Which is the one other thing that the three of these individuals have in common.
Reason why he doesn't have a special counsel is because he has not declared yet. Right.
And so does that...
That's interesting.
So that helped me then. How does Merrick Garland process that question in the sense that, the facts between Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and Mike Pence, Trump is over here. Pence and Biden, to the best of our knowledge, facts can change, are over here, right. In that they discovered these documents at their houses. They raised their hands,
yep.
And said, let's go through this. So, but Merrick Garland felt he had no choice but to name the special counsel in the president's case, President Biden's case, because Donald Trump's a declared candidate. President Biden is a presumed candidate. Mike Pence is sort of in a never-never land, mm-hmm. and likely candidate, but he hasn't leaned that far forward yet.
Right.
So is that enough for Merrick Garland to say, okay, we cleared this up quickly, we're done, or does he have to do it anyway?
Well, no. I mean, because of those facts, Mike Pence, right, does not present the same conflict of interest in the Justice Department's view of these facts. So that's one reason why, again, if you're Pence and you're trying to maybe get ahead of the calendar here, you want to try to get this wrapped up. And right now, you know, the Justice Department is doing this internally with the FBI. They don't need to go to a special counsel. And it is very, very possible that they can wrap this up. Of course, people at the White House at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue are not happy because they think he should be treated equally with the other two.
Now, they're not happy. This one gets
cannot make everyone happy at this town at the same time. Nobody. It's impossible.
Right. If you had brought this script to... Yeah, never mind. I'll just leave it there. Up next for us, this is a very important story, global story. New American military access to bases in the Philippines. Beijing calling it a provocation. The Biden White House says it is a necessary response to Chinese aggression toward Taiwan and across the region. Showing you the House of Representatives floor just moments ago, the House finishing its vote to remove Congressman Ilhan Omar, a Democrat from Minnesota, from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. That vote was 218 to 211. One member of the House voted present on that vote. There's a separate vote happening now. That's the screen you see there. But 218 to 211, one vote present. Ilhan Omar will be removed from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The resolution doing that does offer her an opportunity to appeal to the House Ethics Committee. We'll watch that as it plays out. But a major victory for the new Republican Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. Ilhan Omar will be removed from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Moving on now to some important global news. Some new Russian missile strikes targeting civilians in eastern Ukraine, sending plumes of smoke over the city of Kramatorsk as residents scramble to take cover. Our CNN correspondent Fred Plykin was right there near one apartment building hit during that attack. Here's how he described his close call with CNN's Kate Baldwin last hour.
We had just arrived on the scene, had parked our vehicles, had gotten out of those vehicles, when another missile struck in the exact building that we were parked in front of. So we heard a loud bang. There were obviously a lot of civilians there on the street, many of them then trying to take shelter. We did the same thing. We then went towards another building to try and take shelter there. And then as I looked up, I saw another missile that then hit almost the exact location, obviously causing a huge explosion there, leading to even more people trying to flee the scene. We then tried to run for cover, went for shelter, and then after a while tried to get out of there. But I think One of the things that's very important to point out, Kate, is that there was a big search and rescue operation going on the ground, and the Russians targeted exactly the area where that search and rescue operation was going on in the city of Kramatorsk. This was not some sort of military facility. We saw no military facilities in that area. We saw a lot of civilians, however, who were in that area, and this was right in the center of town.
Our thanks to Fred Plotkin there and all our CNN teams on the ground across Ukraine at a very dangerous moment in this war, about to hit the one-year mark. Let's move on to another major global story now, increasing tensions between the United States and China. The United States announcing today it will expand its military presence in the Philippines. It is a step the Pentagon says is important because of China's threatening behavior toward Taiwan and across the region. This deal coming ahead of Secretary of State Tony Blinken's upcoming visit to China. Let's discuss now with our CNN Pentagon correspondent Oren Lieberman and our CNN International correspondent Mark Stewart. Oren, let's begin with you, the defense secretary going to the Philippines to announce this new expansion. I just want to show a map. The United States has a military presence in the Philippines, but this agreement will allow it to expand its presence at four bases in the Philippines. The message is just unmistakable. The United States want more access for more sophisticated weaponry, naval and otherwise, in this region. Explain why the Pentagon thinks it is necessary and why now.
The Pentagon, as well as the U.S. government, have watched China, its actions, its military operations, and view it as a growing threat not only towards Taiwan, but also other countries in the region, as they view China as becoming more aggressive. This, clearly and especially from China's perspective, puts more U.S. military forces closer to China and, of course, as you see on that map, closer to Taiwan. There are already forces on the northern side there in Okinawa, where the U.S. just announced it would repurpose a Marine Corps unit, giving it advanced capabilities and advanced weapons recently. And now, with this new access agreement, there could be forces even closer on the south side. Now, neither the U.S. nor the Philippines have said where these four bases are, but we know from previous statements from the Philippines that the U.S. has requested access in the northern Philippines. Again, that's that spot very close to Taiwan. So this is all part of the broader access, the broader move to shift from the wars of the past in the Middle East and towards China, towards the Indo-Pacific. It's also worth remembering that from the sort of 10,000-foot level, the previous Philippine administration had moved the country toward Beijing, and this appears to be a clear realignment from the new Philippine government moving back towards Washington, a bit back towards the U.S., even as the government remains very careful with how it interacts and works with Beijing, John.
Oren, thank you. And to Mark Stewart now in the region. Mark, there are already weeks and weeks, months and months of tensions between China and the Biden administration over military matters, over economic matters, over technology matters. I want you to listen here. This is the spokesman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry this morning saying this is the U.S. fault, that the U.S. is the aggressor here.
The U.S., which clings to a zero-sum mentality, continues to strengthen its military deployment in the region out of its own interests. It is aggravating regional tension and jeopardizing regional peace and stability. Countries in the region should stay alert and avoid being coerced by the U.S.
What is the sense, Mark, of tensions in the region? Especially, you have this act, expanding military presence in the Philippines. You had the memo from the Air Force General the other day saying war could be possible in the relatively near future. What to make of this?
I mean, tension is high, John, and this is how the Chinese government typically responds, at least at this moment in time, using powerful and pointed language. That spokesperson went on to say that the U.S. has a selfish agenda, suggesting that the U.S. was holding on to the Cold War. And then, as you heard at the end of that statement, made a warning to other nations in the region to take caution that perhaps you could be used by the U.S. This is very much in line with the Chinese response. And by expanding it to other nations, shows that China is trying to make a forceful power play in this whole broader area.
Remarkable moment. Mark Stewart in Hong Kong, Oren Lieberman at the Pentagon. Grateful to have you both to help us through it. When we come back any moment now, the House Speaker Kevin McCarthy takes a victory lap. That after delivering the votes to boot the Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar off the House Foreign Affairs Committee. That's next. Take you live up to the United States Capitol now, the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and the first woman governor in Arkansas, and the very first
father-daughter, ever-to-be governor of a state, is going to give our State of the Union response. And we're excited about it, especially what she's been able to achieve so far as governor in Arkansas. So I'm very excited by that. We'll also have Juan Ciscomani giving a response in Spanish as well. As many of you know, Juan's story, immigrating to America, age 11, his father drove the bus in Tucson, Arizona. Just a real true American story as well. Yesterday I had a meeting with the president. I got to see the president again this morning. I was like that he said it was a good meeting as well to me. No predetermined ideas, but we're going to meet again about the debt ceiling and ways that we can find ways for savings and put ourselves on a path to balance. I think that's very important. If you look any of the latest polls, 74% of Americans believe there has to be some savings in what we're spending. We're at 120% of GDP, meaning our debt is larger than our economy. It's one of the greatest threats we have to this nation. And when I look at it, if you look at just the last 12 years in Congress, Republicans controlled 8 years of that and Democrats controlled four. In the last 4 years that the Democrats controlled, they increased discretionary spending by 30%, more than $400 billion. Now, we had controlled it for twice as long. Discretionary spending during those 8 years didn't go up $1. They actually went down $10 billion. So I know we can find savings and get our economy stronger. After when Republicans were in the majority, we were able to pass that tax package. Revenue into the government has never been higher. It's the highest revenue we've ever seen in. So it's not a revenue problem, it's a spending problem. So we'll continue to work on that. A couple interesting things happen on the floor right now. You had almost, if you combine the number of Democrats who voted no and voted present, there's 100 Democrats that won't stand up against socialism. That's a real concern to me in America today. It's not just, that wasn't a college vote on a college campus. That was a vote in the U.S. Congress that 100 Democrats couldn't say socialism was wrong. That's a scary point of view, but you also understand why we're in a spending problem that they are when they were in the majority. That's why you understand the challenges that we have here. So let me stop there and take any questions you might have. Yes, sir.
When you, the White House, said that the president's open to a talking about the debt ceiling and a separate discussion about ways to control spending. I mean, what do you think about when you hear that they kind of want to separate those two, is what they say?
Whichever way they want to talk about it, I'm very clear. We will not pass a clean debt ceiling here without some form of spending reform. So there'll never be a clean one. I don't know how they want to say it. That's fine. But at the end of the day, we're going to get spending reforms. I believe you have to lift the debt ceiling. But you do not lift the debt ceiling without changing your behavior. So it's got to be both in front. Yes, sir.
Some of your own members who voted for this Omar resolution, like Congresswoman Mace and Congressman Gonzalez, are concerned of what they see as sort of like tit-for-tat retribution that your new majority is taking against a Democratic member of the House. Is this the message you want to send to voters as you come into power here?
No, and that's the clear part, how it's not tit-for-tat. So let's just put it in perspective of what the Democrats did and what Republicans are doing. So the Democrats in the last Congress removed Republican members from all committees. They even judged one Republican member not based upon what she had said as a member of Congress, but what she said prior to ever getting here. And they removed from all committees. I'm not removing people from all committees. And I'm not judging something that someone said when they're not a member of Congress. Now, the first two people we did not allow to be on Intel. If you got the briefing I got from the FBI, and I know you all personally believe it as well, simply as an American, you know Swalwell should not serve on the Intel. I'd love to take a show of hands here. How many believe, if you're a member of Congress and the FBI says nothing, but the moment your leadership appoints you to the Intel Committee, the FBI comes knocking on the leadership's door and says, we have a problem, this person has a relationship with a Chinese spy. How many believe that that person should stay on Intel? So, yes, it's not the same, and he's no longer on Intel. But there are a number of other Democrats concerned. Now, the chairman of the Intel Committee, Adam Schiff, I actually believe I helped him. Because what he did to the Intel Committee, he used that position as chairman, knowing classified information that others didn't, and he conveyed to the American public something that was not true to try to confuse them on a number of times, from the whistleblower. Even the Washington Post acknowledged that is true. What he did when he went after Devin Nunes, even the inspector general said he was lying about that. He turned the Intel Committee into an impeachment committee. So now Schiff serves on Judiciary. That is actually the committee for impeachment. That is where he should serve. So now the Intel Committee would go back to the responsibility that it has to protect the American public. Now, when it comes to Congresswoman Omar, based upon what she had said, the anti-Semitic comments, it's all about the Benjamins. The military in America is equal to Hamas and the Taliban. On 9/11, something happened that day. Even the former Democratic chair of the committee believed her comments were wrong. When a resolution was brought up to deal with this last time, she never apologized. They changed the resolution to say anti-Semitism is wrong. We're not removing her from other committees. We just do not believe when it comes to foreign affairs, especially the responsibility of that position around the world with the comments that you make. She shouldn't serve there. But this is what the clear, this, if it was tit for tat, we would have picked people, took them off all committees and said nothing about it. We don't believe in that. I just had a conversation with the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries. What I asked him to do was to select a couple members along with himself and mine, and I have a couple members, and one's going to be Nancy Mace to help, and Ken Buck and some others. And I think what we should do is put into the rules. There is a code of conduct here, but I don't know the definition exactly what all that's going to mean. I think that should be clear. So if there is a concern, it's not tit for tat, but I think in moving forward, every single member of Congress has a responsibility to how they carry themselves. Let me finish the question. And it's responsible upon us to let them know what that is, and then what is the due process in a bipartisan way that we can deal with it. So I'm going to put a group of Democrats that Hakeem will select and a group of Republicans, and we'll work to come and clarify the rules and pass something for not only this Congress, but future Congresses as well.
There's an acrimony right now in Congress. We've seen it play out in many of these committee hearings where members are calling each other names. This vote with Congresswoman Omar is a backdrop against this. With the acrimony between Republicans and Democrats right now, how can the American people be confident that you'll be able to get things done?
Because this is nothing like the last Congress where you move somebody from all committees. This is nothing like the last Congress where you have a speaker that tells Republicans they can't even be on committees. This is nothing like the last Congress where they would deny the rights for bills to even go through committee. This is nothing like the last Congress where you never had an open rule. So let's just judge the few weeks we've had now to the last Congress. This is the first time in 7 years any bill has come to the floor in an open rule. Almost a decade since that has come to a bill has come to the floor that's not an appropriation bill. Look at what we've also done the first week. In a bipartisan way, 146 Democrats joined with us where we opened a select committee on China. This is actually a fundamentally different Congress. I've had Democrats coming up to me telling me we're running it much better, especially the time allotment. They like the openness and the working. I'll give you another example for an inner workings, right? There's times that I was going to be given a briefing. I call up the minority leader, take the briefing with me. Because there's ways that I look at the way we were treated in the past I don't think was right. And I'm glad you asked this question because this is a much different Congress, much more. Now the public can actually be here. You can be here, which how different is that? The public is going to be back in the people's house. We're going to have a State of the Union where the public can actually watch it. So, yeah, I'm really excited how this is so different than the last Congress.
Just to follow up on Jeffrey.
I'm really
the Republican Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, holding a news conference in Statuary Hall at the United States Capitol. A bit of a victory lap. His Republican majority just voted to kick Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota, off the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The Speaker explaining that, also proposing potentially a circuit breaker, saying he has met with his Democratic colleague, Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic minority leader. He says he wants to put a group together to try to come up with a code of conduct so that this doesn't keep happening. Let's bring the conversation in the room. Is it? He did not dispute. The question was, there's a lot of acrimony here mm-hmm. right now. He did not dispute that. He says he thinks he can make it better. Is that potentially an off-ramp to at least turn the temperature down? You're not going to end it.
I mean, that would be nice. Let's be optimists. Right. It would certainly be nice. That was also one of the demands from Republican Nancy Mace to say, look, I will be with you on this vote with Ilhan Omar, but we can't keep doing this. Mm-hmm. So this may be an indicator of all of the pressure that we saw when Kevin McCarthy was trying to get the votes to become speaker came from the far right. this may be a sort of a teeny bit of an indicator, early indicator, mm-hmm. of the fact that the moderates, I don't know, 17 or so of them in the Republican conference also have power. Because every group that is more than five people has power because the majority is so slim.
And so this is, these are his early days, critical for any leader. He's the new leader of an organization with a very narrow majority. He also said he's trying to be upbeat about his meeting with the president yesterday. They are very far apart. The White House says it will not negotiate the debt ceiling. But the president of the United States did say he'll have a separate conversation about spending cuts or spending reductions if you vote. Kevin McCarthy says you have to have the spending cuts with the vote on a debt ceiling, that they won't have a clean debt ceiling bill, meaning he'd have to spend. Can they do that? Is the White House essentially saying we'll negotiate as long as we do it in separate meetings?
I mean, if you listen to both what the White House has said and what Speaker McCarthy is saying, I mean, they're, you can do a little bit of verbal gymnastics to make them both right and make both sides happy at the end of the day. But right now, especially if anything appears to be tied to the debt limit, that's something that the White House is really sensitive about. They have said over and over that they are not negotiating on raising the borrowing authority. We went through this in 2011. It ended in near catastrophe, and we don't want to get into actual catastrophe this time.
So you can describe a process that both sides can say that worked. We didn't violate our principles. The problem is then you have to come to specifics. You're going to have spending reductions, what are they?
Right. Yeah, I think that's the big question. There are a number of months to get this done, so it's not like this is hanging over their head right now. Kevin McCarthy has said he wants to get it done sooner rather than later, but he's got this caucus that really is going to want to have some cuts, and they also have this power over him, meaning they can remove him from his position if he doesn't go along with them. So this is going to be a very tough set of negotiations and conversations between McCarthy and his caucus and McCarthy and the White House.
You, at the beginning of the program, channeled Dewan Siskamani as a response.
That
to the
is so weird.
I'm going to channel that it'll be Senate Democrats from Trump states up in 2024 that helped the president out of this spending issue because they have to run for re-election. Thanks for your time today on Inside Politics. Busy day of breaking news. Casey Hunt picks up right after a quick break.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.